Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Puerto Rico has turned on its governor as deep unrest reaches the surface. Puerto Rico has reached a turning point, with hundreds of thousands of protesters demanding that a generation of corruption, graft, and class warfare come to an end. Their target? Governor Ricardo Rosselló, who is facing the threat of impeachment as the streets fill with anger, frustration, and impatience. This seems to have been a turn from what was going on last week, and not for the better as far as the governor is concerned. For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is a Sputnik journalist. He is a producer of By Any Means Necessary, Bob Schlehuber. Bob, welcome back from Puerto Rico.
Thanks for having me.
And based upon the reports that are now coming through the media sources today, what's your take on what they're saying is going on now versus what you just left?
Yeah, sure. The big news was last night, Ricky Rosselló, the governor, coming out and saying that he won't resign his seat, but he is stepping down as the president of the new Progressive Party, and that he won't seek re-election in 2020. I'm not sure if that's a big surprise that he won't be seeking re-election. I don't think he needed to come out and tell anybody. And people were angry last night. I mean, talk about throwing fuel onto the fire for the guy to come out, take everybody's time, said, hey, here's some message. The first time he's spoken to the populace at large since a press conference much earlier in the week. And for him to come out and say, no, I'm actually not going to resign, but at least I can promise you I'm not going to run again. So media coverage has been all right, at least today. They're showing some 400,000 people taking Highway 18 in Puerto Rico, just a massive turnout. So you are getting some more attention now after 11 days of protests. I thought Fox News, CNN, international media starting to pick it up. Obviously not to the degree in which if it would have happened here in the lower 48 states in the United States, but obviously the story's been trickling out and being followed by the mainstream media a little bit more now. So now the next question is, how long do these strikes continue? And for me, I think they continue until Rosselló leaves office. To be there on the ground and to hear so many people united around a singular cause was remarkable. I've never heard or seen anything like it. Having followed the protests here in the United States, in Washington, D.C. specifically, over the last 2 years or so, you've seen big, massive turnouts, but there's always been a kind of a partisan atmosphere to it. It's us versus them, and mostly that them has been Donald Trump. And so you've seen kind of a partisan nature, and that's why Trump's been able to at least stay in power a lot longer. There hasn't been a mass call across the ideological spectrum. Imagine if you had people from the far left of the Democratic Party to right-wing Republicans collectively calling for Trump to leave. It would be one scene, but that's not what we have here. In Puerto Rico, that's what you have. You have everyone across the board, all economic, socioeconomic status. You have the church calling for him to resign. You have a spokesperson who has resigned her position because she could no longer defend the governor. You have the top administrative officials within his cabinet have already resigned their seats. So you have a broad call for his resignation, and that was the most striking thing to see take place, and to have hundreds of thousands of people. Again, the island's 3.2 million people, and to have 10% or more of your populace on the streets today, shutting down one of your main economic thoroughfares, closing down one of the largest malls on the island. The economy is at a standstill, and it's an economy that's been plagued by Wall Street debt financing. People can't afford to lose money, and yet they're willing to go ahead and lose money. Tell you one just quick anecdote. I was talking to a business owner, and she said, you know what? I've been talking to other business owners and been following it on social media. Every night, the protesters have been spray painting different things, graffiti on the walls, calling for the resignation of Rosselló, calling him a dictator, calling for independence, all that stuff. She said, we're more than happy to continue to pay for the paint to paint over it the next morning because we need to. We're happy to do it. Keep protesting, keep spray painting, keep doing this. And so people are at a point where they're willing to actually hurt their own economic interest to get Rosselló out. And once you get people at that level, then you know people are angry.
You mentioned Donald Trump's name, and since the hurricane hit, there's been a sense, at least from my interpretation, that people have tended to equate Rosselló with Trump versus the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yolin Cruz. Is that a fair dichotomy to draw between Rosselló equating him with being more in line with Trump and versus Carmen Cruz.
I mean, we found out that Ryan Zinke, the former Department of Interior, one of his good friends, got one of those special sweetheart contracted deals in Puerto Rico. So it's not as if the Trump administration hasn't also been corrupt in relation to how money has made its way to the island since Hurricane Maria. And obviously Donald Trump's big tax cuts for the ultra wealthy, those ultra wealthy own debt in Puerto Rico. So Trump by no means has done been a friend of the Puerto Rican people, even though now he's trying to play it off of, I told you guys this, the guy was corrupt, he had to go this whole time. And so it's one of those kind of weird moments where you're like, wait a second, do I agree with Donald Trump on this corrupt thing? And you obviously do. He is making a valid point, but he too is absolutely corrupt. So there is quite a bit of similarity. It's just the callous nature. I mean, I think that's what really struck people. It was like, not only did people have to deal with loved ones and family members dying, not only do they have to live about their economic future on the island. I mean, talking to people, like, they desperately want to stay. That's their home. And they're just not sure if they can when there's a much better opportunity in the U.S. So for Roseo to be coming out and finding these transcripts, talking about feeding dead bodies to the crows, to be making fun of islanders for either their sexual orientation or their body weight, even in some of those messages, it's just beyond the pale. And Roseo trying to say, oh, with long days blowing off.
And attacking Carmen Cruz.
Attacking Carmen Cruz, saying either like, we'll put a bullet in her head, that would be a great favor to the governor, he said, or even making reference to her mental health condition and her taking her medicines and stuff like that. It's just beyond the pale. It's not blowing off a long day of 17 hours and being traumatized and stressed. Imagine trying to rescue people in the wake of the hurricane. You could see how trauma and stress would build for anybody trying to respond to that, but to blow off steam or to find relaxation and joking with your bros in these private text chats, the way in which they did was just beyond anybody's ability to stomach.
The Washington Post is reporting Puerto Ricans have come together as a singing, chanting, pot-banging union of voices in Old San Juan and far-flung Pueblo plazas. They are arriving en masse by car, kayak, boat, and horse day after day. If I were talking to Ricardo Rosario, you have been a long-term activist and organizer, I'd have to say, hey, Ricky, I think you blew this one, partner. Because when you and I were talking last week, the sense I got from you was the issues were pretty much centered around him and centered around these text messages and yeah. tweets. And it now seems to have moved from that to the entire geopolitical landscape in Puerto Rico and the problems that they've had post Maria and his failure to improve the standard of living for people in Puerto Rico. It seems now to be the history of Puerto Rico has overcome Ricardo Rosselló.
Yeah, and I think Roseo is in trouble, and I do, again, I think he will resign and be forced out of office. And the big question then for Puerto Ricans is then how do you actually recover not only from the hurricane, not only from centuries of colonial rule, how do you now recover from this political crisis that you're now in? Because whoever comes in next, they still have to get billions of dollars from the United States government that's still owed to them for recovery, that they're in complete crisis mode, regardless of what happens with Roseo.
Real quick, because we only have about a minute left, there were reports that his father might step in because his father was a former governor.
Yeah, sure. Pedro Roseo was a governor in the 90s. You could guess at how the people of Puerto Rico will respond if a Roseo stays in that seat, Doctor. So I'll let you be the guest at how they would take that if he's the one that's appointed.
But
to
I just
that
wanted
seat
to be now. Sure we got that point out there.
Yeah, I mean, and the big question, I'm kind of curious if there's some type of legal ramifications that Roseo is now afraid of being brought against him. We already have 50-some indictments brought against his former secretary, education secretary, as well as the person who oversaw the health insurance on the island, that if Roseo thinks FBI indictments are coming, he might be in a better situation to be the governor when those do come to be able to cover legal fees with his governorship mm-hmm. intact, that he may not want to resign and not be the former governor who's then arrested as opposed to the governor who's arrested. So there might be quite a bit behind the scenes still unfolding that we haven't yet seen, but obviously we'll continue to follow the story as it unfolds.
Bob Schlehuber, hey, glad you made it back safely
Appreciate
from
it.
Puerto Rico. And thank you so much for your time today and for your insight. And I know we will be calling upon you again because this is not going away anytime soon. Hey, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. two stories here that I want to cover in the same segment. A meme called Four Democrats the Jihad Squad. A state GOP group is sorry for sharing it. While an officer in Louisiana suggests that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez should be shot after he read a fake news story on Facebook. According to the movie poster style picture that was recently shared to an official Facebook page for Republican leaders in Illinois, Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar's face is contorted into an attitude-filled pout, and she appears to be toting a large gun. Below her are the doctored images of three fellow Democratic congresswomen, Representatives Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, and Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. They are referenced as the Jihad Squad with a caption, "Political jihad is their game. If you don't agree with their socialist ideology, you're racist." And then it's not clear from his Facebook post whether police officer Charlie Rispoli knew he was responding to a fake post when he suggested that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez should be shot. How dangerous is this rhetoric becoming? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a communication strategist for In the Public Eye Communications. She is Joya Jefferson Neary. Joya, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate this.
So for a very long time, this has unfortunately become the new nauseating normal in terms of a lot of incredibly inflammatory rhetoric from the president. But now you have Republican representatives and politicians in Illinois creating these memes, and you also now have police officers responding to fake postings on Facebook saying that a standing member of Congress should be shot. Your thoughts as a communication strategist?
Well, as a communication strategist for the state of Illinois, it was a deliberate communication, in my opinion. No one in that state office, no one who was managing their social media thought there was anything wrong with this. It goes back to H&M having a monkey on a t-shirt worn by a black child, calling him the greatest monkey in the jungle. I don't think these things are mistakes. I don't think it's ignorance. I don't think they are doing it. It's a trial balloon. If H&M could have gotten away with that, there would have been coats and slacks and hats and everything else that had that monkey on it. And they would have marketed it to the same audience they're insulting. They didn't get away with it. And I say the same thing for the state of Illinois, for the Republican Party in Illinois. And the state of Illinois would have done the same. I do not believe that a group of politicians are that politically unsavvy, that they didn't understand what they were doing. What they were doing was dog whistling their own or shouting out, hey, to their own and making their message clear. And then they take it down and apologize. And then what happens is they leave it up for an hour or two, and then the rest of the media takes care of it for the next 3 days. They made their message clear. Was not a mistake.
Talk about that, because one of the things that has really, really, there are two things. They're both basically the same, that have really, really annoyed me. One is now this term, walking it back, as though you can say something and then unring the bell. And the other is, to what you just said, posting something and then taking it down as though removing it, again, unrings the bell. You said what you said. You posted what you posted. Now own it. And we should say what we mean and mean what we say.
But this is, you know why you know this is not an accident? Somebody drew that meme.
Spent a lot of time doing it.
And spent a lot of time doing it and posted the pictures of the other three congresswomen in it and crafted the words. This was not something they did in 5 minutes. This wasn't, you know, everybody sitting at the bar and you say something into your phone that's not appropriate. This was artwork. It was well-done artwork.
Yes, it was.
And it was well-done artwork. But what I'm saying is that they knew. And you cannot, you know, maybe you could have walked things back. in 1965, before there was 24-hour media, before there was the internet, maybe you could have walked a statement back and apologized, because it was only going to be told on the radio and at the end of the day on the CBS Evening News.
Right.
But now, I think I've seen it already today like 17 times. I mean, I heard about it. Mm-hmm. 17 times.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where you go, it's in the headline, it flashes up on your phone. No, there's no such thing as walking it back. But you're only walking it back as part of the political strategy.
That's important to understand that it's the point of it is to get the message out.
Absolutely.
And then once you get the message out, knowing how vile it is, and knowing it's not as though
how viral it will be.
It's not as though you're testing the waters to see what the reaction is going to be. You know what the reaction is going to be. And so to your point, I just hate the term, we're now going to walk it back, or you're going to have a spokesperson come out now and say, well, what he really or what she really meant was.
But I think that it behooves those people who create the stories, the media, the bloggers, the vloggers, the people who are there in the room, who interview the politicians, and you'll be interviewing politicians in so many outlets. You should stop accepting this wasn't part of the strategy.
Let's talk.
It's not a mistake.
It's not a mistake. And to ignore that point is to give them a pass.
Is to give them a pass. And since when do we accept apologies from politicians? Politicians lose their jobs. Politicians are unelected. Since when can a politician or a group of politicians, as in the GOP, apologize and we go for it? We impeach people who have apologized.
Let's shift gears here to police officer Charlie Rispoli from Gretna, Louisiana, who posted on Facebook in response or in reaction to a fake posting, well, it was real, but it wasn't what he thought it was, regarding Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, quote, "This vile idiot needs a round, and I don't mean the kind she used to serve." Basically talking about
when she was a waitress.
When she was a waitress and that now she needs to be shot. I think
Wilmer,
the game
Wilmer,
is changed. Yes, ma'am.
Anybody in the blue who calls for anybody to be shot, whether what they read was the truth or it was a fake news piece, needs to lose their job and be investigated.
Oh, absolutely.
Let alone a member of Congress. He just called for the assassination.
Yes.
Of a member of Congress.
That's a felony.
It's a felony.
That's a felony.
I wouldn't care if the story he read was true or if the story he read was fake. He has sworn to protect, defend, and protect. It's a felony if you did it.
No, absolutely.
It's a felony if I did it.
Absolutely.
He took an oath, put on a uniform, put on a badge. I don't know if you can get two felonies, but that's two felonies.
And he's licensed to carry a firearm, so his ability to carry out the threat.
Absolutely.
Is also a factor.
He should be removed from that. The city should apologize to the nation, and he should go on trial.
But here's my reason for pointing out that the posting was fake, because I want to get to beyond this individual act and look at the broader landscape of the danger that this rhetoric is posing. And we seem to be getting closer and closer and closer to that less than sane individual following up on this language and this incredibly offensive, dangerous rhetoric. That's the point. For example, I don't want to talk about Trump's silly tweets on Sunday, because that's just Donald Trump being Donald Trump. What I want to get to is how that's resonating across the country, and how is it that he can then have a rally that has thousands of people chanting, "Send her back." To me, the danger is not the tweet. The danger is the reaction from the public to the tweet. That's what I'd like to get your take on.
The danger of the tweet is yelling fire in a theater. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Falsely
yelling
fire in a crowded theater. Absolutely right.
And he meant to yell fire in a crowded theater. He cannot win this election on policies or getting jobs or anything. He's going to do the same thing on this election as he did, rile up people's fear and anxieties. That's how he got elected before. That's how he did his base. That's how he can do whatever. Even his birther movement from 2006 or 7 through the 2008 campaign and beyond, 300 times more death threats against Barack Obama than any other president since they've been keeping this record. And not just
even as a candidate.
Barack Obama was African descendant, African American. It's because they were riled up about him being a socialist, about him being a Muslim, and about him being not born in the United States.
He was the most threatened candidate in the history of this country. Not only president, candidate.
And not only that, one candidate was actually assassinated. I mean, Bobby Kennedy was actually assassinated on this. And Barack Obama got more threats. And so I think that it does harken back to Donald Trump. I think that we see more of this because they've been given permission to talk. It's not like racism comes and goes. It's there. It's a consistent force in our country. But the culture changes to a point where the people in the highest offices, those people who are leaders, whether they're cultural leaders or church leaders or Greek leaders, sort of set a tone for how the nation must engage, how you must engage. And that tone is coming from the White House now and from the Republican members of Congress who will not shut him up.
I also think it's important to point out, to discuss this thing in its totality, that he was seizing upon the rift that is growing between Speaker Pelosi and the so-called squad. That Nancy Pelosi has come out saying, trying to basically diminish the significance of these ladies by saying, oh, there are only four of them. They only have four votes, or they don't really have the constituency that they proclaim to have. And that as the four of them have been trying to push Democratic establishment and leadership further to the left after the Clintons had moved the party further to the right, that Donald Trump sees the rift that's growing in the party and is using these hyperbolic tactics in order to seize upon that rift.
I want to disagree with that.
Okay.
I want to say that Donald Trump hadn't noticed the Nancy Pelosi stuff, him as an individual. Maybe his team did. Maybe they did. But I don't think that Donald Trump is doing anything to side himself with Nancy Pelosi. He's not in agreement with Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that he is. No, what I'm saying, no, hang on, Joya. I'm not saying that he is. In fact, I gave a speech yesterday, and this is part of what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Donald Trump is without a doubt the most ignorant president that we have ever had. But for as ignorant as he is, he isn't stupid. And for us to try, the public, not.
Yeah, yeah.
For people to try to play him as stupid, play him for stupid at your own peril, just ask Hillary Clinton.
Yes, yes.
So, no, I'm not saying that he's siding with Nancy Pelosi. I'm saying he's capitalizing on what he perceives to be an opportunity as he sees a rift between Nancy and the squad. That's what I'm saying.
I want to continue to lovingly disagree.
That's fine. Okay.
On this point, Hillary Clinton won the election. Hillary Clinton ran a bad election and didn't go into the states with the highest electoral college votes. But Hillary Clinton, as far as the voters are concerned, won that election.
And we could even talk about Greg Palast and the cross-check program and that she even won the electoral college. But let's not have that conversation right now. I need to wrap it up. Go ahead.
I'm just saying that Donald Trump saw four women he actually thought were all immigrants, and he is just that racist.
Okay. All right. I got to stop you there.
Okay.
We're going to pick this one up.
Oh, absolutely. Can't wait.
But I got to get out. Joya Jefferson Nuri, communication strategist for the In the Public Eye Communications. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are are back, and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Israel demolishes Palestinian homes near a West Bank barrier. Israeli forces demolished a cluster of Palestinian homes near a military barrier on the outskirts of Jerusalem today in the face of protests and international criticism. Israel said the 10 apartment buildings, most of them still under construction, had been built illegally and posed a security risk to Israeli armed forces operating along the barrier that runs through the occupied West Bank. Palestinians fear that the razing of buildings near what Israel describes as a security barrier against Palestinian attacks will set a precedent for other towns along its route, which snakes through the West Bank for hundreds of kilometers. How dangerous of a situation is this, and what is the message that the government is sending? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an author and human rights activist born in Jerusalem. He's the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, as well as Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, Miko Peled. Miko, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
You write in your Mint Press piece entitled "The Roots of Evil, Right-Wing Israeli Settler Group Accuses Palestinians of Land Theft." You write, "Israeli settler groups are turning the Israel-Palestine narrative on its head, accusing Palestinians of trying to illegally steal land in the West Bank's Area C in a move designed to shock Israeli settlers in the West Bank into action." Activists from the right-wing settler organization Regavim hung Palestinian flags along the main West Bank settler roads last week. Is there any relationship between the demolition of the Palestinian apartment buildings near the West Bank that I opened with and the organization that you write about in your piece called Regavim?
I think what's important to take into consideration is that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has been under a lot of pressure by the settler groups, who wield a lot of political power and have a great deal of support in Israel, to do two things. One is to de-Arabize East Jerusalem and to build for Jews only. And the second thing is to make sure that Area C, which is the largest portion, over 60% of the West Bank, is also inhabited by Jews, and so that, you know, the government builds heavily in that area. Now, Netanyahu wants their support. He's got elections coming up again, and if he can get them to vote for him as opposed to voting for the smaller right-wing groups, then he will undoubtedly remain as prime minister and form the next government. So that's really what he wants to do. So this destruction, I mean, Israel's been destroying Palestinian homes and you know, for 70 years, there's nothing new about that. And building for Jews only on Palestinian land all over Palestine, there's nothing new about that. This time, it is definitely Netanyahu signaling to his right-wing most constituents to say, look, I'm strong man, I'm with you. Now, these particular homes were built with permission of the Palestinian Authority. They're not in Area C. They're in Area B, which is Palestinian-controlled, should be Palestinian-controlled. So because they could not build in the areas where they originally wanted to, they moved past the so-called line between Area C and B, and they got permits from the Palestinian Authority. Now what Israel is saying is their presence there of these apartment buildings, beautiful apartment buildings, by the way, you should see them, the marble, the stone. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see the destruction of these beautiful homes, of these beautiful apartment buildings. That it's a security risk because it's too close to the boundary between Area B and C, which is complete nonsense. But this is their excuse to destroy, and very soon, and at the same time, Israel is allowing the building of what is considered illegal settlements in Area C, which are kind of outposts that pop up without government permission. He's ignoring them and allowing them to grow and build and so forth because they are Jews. And this exactly, once again, is to appease and to seduce, if you will, the right-wing most extremist of the Israeli political map in order for them to vote for him as prime minister as opposed to the smaller political, you know, right-wing parties.
You mentioned that the apartment buildings were built with permission and licensing by the Palestinian Authority. Is this an attempt by the Israeli government to demonstrate, or another action by the Israeli government to demonstrate that the Palestinian Authority has no authority?
Absolutely. I mean, they've been undermining the Palestinian Authority since day one. And so they do that by military incursions into Area A, into Palestinian cities. I mean, it's not uncommon to see Israeli troops in Ramallah, in Bethlehem, in some of the other Palestinian cities that are supposedly under Palestinian control, going in there, making arrests, raiding towns and villages and so forth. So they've been undermining the Palestinian Authority from the very beginning. This, on the issue of Jerusalem, or anything that is or close to Jerusalem, is a hot political button. And really, for the right-wing factions, which again, many of whom are now sitting in his cabinet anyway, they want as much of what is considered, you know, the expanded boundaries of Jerusalem to be Jewish only. They've got this entire vision of Jerusalem extending all the way to the north to Ramallah and all the way to the south to Bethlehem, and expelling all of the Palestinians, you know, thousands or millions of Palestinians that live in between, and create this greater Jerusalem and then build a Jewish temple instead of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. This is the end game. This is for them the big plan. And Netanyahu wants to signal to them, you know, I'm your man, vote for me, you're going to get what you want. And the next actually realistic step is going to be claiming sovereignty over Area C, which is the Israelis call Judea and Samaria.
You mentioned that there's a lot of political power in the settler groups. Are these settler groups primarily indigenous Israelis, or are they transplants from the United States and Europe?
Both. I mean, many of them, their leaders are mostly Israeli, but they're both. They're Israelis, and many of them are Americans. Many of them are French. Many of them are British. When you walk around Hebron, for example, the old city of Hebron, where they are, or in Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, where these guys are very active in taking Palestinian homes and kicking Palestinians out. Very often you hear very, very heavy American or British or French accents when these guys talk. But not all of them. Many of them are indigenous Israelis that were already born in settlements. In other words, we're talking about, you know, the Israeli settlements in what used to be the West Bank have been going on for 50 years. We're talking about leaders today who are, you know, people who are in their already holding political positions of leadership who were born there. This is all they know. So they are absolutely Israeli Jews.
In your Mint Press piece, again, entitled The Roots of Evil, Right-Wing Israeli Settler Group Accuses Palestinians of Land Theft, you write, Regevim also published a comprehensive in-depth report titled The Roots of Evil, Land Theft in Area C is Creating a De Facto Palestinian State. And you talk about a secret program dubbed the Roots Project. Talk about that, please.
Well, that's what these guys are claiming. These guys are claiming that the Palestinians are encroaching into Palestinian land, that they're stealing. I mean, they're encroaching onto Israeli land or Jewish land. They are stealing water that is not theirs. And that if Israeli government does not act boldly in order to build for Jews only and destroy as many Palestinian towns and villages as possible, then there will one day be a Palestinian state, which they call, you know, a terrorist state and so forth. That's their, these are the words, the names that they use, the terminology that they use. But that's really the fight here. The fight here is for they want every single piece of what they consider to be the land of Israel, from all the way north on the Lebanese border to the very, very south on the Egyptian border and from the river to the sea, to be the land of Israel. And they do not want to see Palestinians. And when you ask them, what are you going to do with the Palestinians? And by the way, the one of these settlers who is now in the cabinet, he's the minister of education in the Israeli government. And I'll say this again, the minister of education. And by the way, he just came up with a statement that he believes in conversion therapy for gay people. But he said clearly, we will take over these lands. We will claim sovereignty over these lands. Palestinians will not have the right to vote. They will not have equal rights. But the vision is the Palestinians will have three choices. They could either capitulate and accept the Jewish state and be good servants of the Jewish state with no rights. They could leave and go anywhere they want, or they can fight and be killed. Those are the three choices that they are willing to present. And these are people sitting in the cabinet right now already with Netanyahu.
So are they, and this might be a silly question, please don't laugh, are they further right than Netanyahu, and is he trying to placate them? Or what's the, if you put these individuals, so I can just have some idea of how all of this fits, if you put them on a political spectrum, Where are they in relationship to each other?
They're not further to the right than Netanyahu. Ideologically, Netanyahu agrees with them.
Okay.
Ideologically, most of the political parties within the Israeli political world agree with them. They all want to see the exact same thing. These guys are the actual gangs that, you know, don't mind going in there and doing the dirty work. They are the leaders of the pack. So Netanyahu needs them. And actually, I wrote about this as well.
Now, wait a minute. When you say they don't mind going in and doing the dirty work, what type of dirty work are you referring to?
Burning Palestinian crops, burning Palestinian olive trees, intimidating Palestinians in the streets, walking around with guns, kicking Palestinians out. It's like a mafia. They're like the mafia soldiers. They're the ones that actually go in on the ground. And Netanyahu needs them. Now, he can't do this because he is, you know, he's a statesman. He's the guy wearing the suit. He's the guy that visits the White House and the Elysee Palace and all these other places around the world. And he meets with Putin. He's like this great statesman. They are the foot soldiers. You know, they're thugs. They're absolute thugs. But ideologically, it's a perfect fit because he agreed. They share the same ideology in terms of the land of Israel and what should happen to the Palestinians. And this is exactly how actually the state of Israel was built from the very beginning. There were these young zealot types of Zionists that went out and did the dirty work and built where they weren't supposed to and got into all the altercations and the intimidation with the local Palestinians. And then the government said, well, now Jews are sitting there, so we have to supply them with water. We have to supply them with security and electricity and roads. You know, even though Palestinians have been living in these places for a very long time without services, as soon as these Israelis show up, and now you have a city. You know, I mean, it goes from an outpost to a settlement to a village to a town. And, you know, 10 years later, you have a city that you can't, that no one could possibly imagine taking out. I mean, it's done. It's a done deal, or removing. So that's how they operate. And these guys are now the foot soldiers. They are radical, fascist, racist, violent. And by the way, they can be all of these things because they have the backing of the Israeli military. So they can go and they don't mind going and intimidating and beating up and bullying Palestinians in the old city of Jerusalem and Hebron and other places, because they know the Israeli government, the Israeli army will always be there to defend them, and they're well armed as well. So these are the people, but ideologically, they all come from this exact same ideology.
You have a paragraph in your piece where you talk about a relationship between many of these Zionists and a right-wing Zionist organization with which counts among its speakers well-known U.S. neocons Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, and Douglas Feith. I didn't read the paragraph because I don't want to butcher a whole bunch of people's names. So I'm hoping that stimulates your memory and that you can speak to that and save me the embarrassment of trying not to butcher these names.
Yeah, it's Hatikva Foundation. It's a foundation that includes all of those names. They raise a great deal of money, supposedly for educational purposes and so forth. But really, it's to support these gangs, these right-wing, neo-Nazi Jewish gangs, Israeli gangs that are out there pushing for a more violent and a more aggressive Israeli policy towards the Palestinians and getting it. And whereas, you know, if you said, you know, 10 years ago, the United States will move its embassy to Jerusalem, people would have said it's absolutely not possible. The Arab world, the Muslim world will never let it happen. There'll be riots. Well, they did it. Nothing happened. If you said a few years ago that tens of thousands of Israelis would be going on these tours that are meant to instigate onto the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Holy Sanctuary compound, just in order to instigate and to be kind of in your face to the Palestinians and to the Muslims, people would have said, nah, that would never be possible. This is a small fringe group. Now these guys are sitting in the cabinet and their plan is to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque and build a Jewish temple instead. Now, my sense is that's where this is all going. And if you talk to people, people say, oh, it'll never happen. The world will never allow it to happen. You know, it's a UNESCO treasure, you know, the Temple Mount, Dome of the Rock, etc. This could happen in a year. And people will say, oh, my goodness, we can't believe it happened. And nothing else is going to happen. So the way they progress is really very, very fast. And the system in which they've been progressing since Israel was established, they're always doing things that people would have thought, oh, they could never happen. And then they happened and the world did not respond, did not react. And Jerusalem is one of those places that everybody thinks, oh, that would be a step too far. I don't know. So far, Israel is doing exactly what it wants to do. And it's got support from organizations like the Tikva Foundation and many others that are very well founded. Ateret Kohanim is another one that works primarily in Jerusalem. And they get away literally with murder. And destroying these homes right now is part of that, destroying these homes on the outskirts of Jerusalem, which are outside the limits of Israeli jurisdiction, by the way. We're using the excuse that they're somehow a security threat. This is exactly part of that.
You used a term in that explanation, neo-Nazi Jewish gang. To me, that sounds like an oxymoron. Help me understand a neo-Nazi Jewish gang. Or did I misunderstand what you said?
No. You didn't misunderstand what I said. You know, there was a great Jewish thinker by the name of Isaiah Leibowitz. He was a religious Orthodox Jew. He was a professor in the Hebrew University, and he was the guru of the left, of the left, way back in the 70s and before that. And I remember as a child seeing him, you know, in Jerusalem growing up. And he coined a phrase in the early 80s, I believe, Judeo-Nazis. And he talked about, he said, every occupation army and every occupation regime is the same. There's no difference. Just because these guys are Jews and the other ones were Germans, it makes no difference. And nobody but him would have dared to coin that term. The fact that they're Jewish doesn't make their brutality, their racism, their violence any different than if they're German or Italian or French or anything else.
Well, now, wait a minute. Let me jump in and just quickly add, and I think we've had this conversation before. One of the questions that I have raised for years is, how can a people who have clung to a history of World War II and oppression and extermination during World War II and use it as a bludgeon against the world, engage in the very same behavior against the Palestinian Arab people? Is my question there along the same line?
Fascism and racism is not something that belongs to one nation or one group of people. I mean, just because somebody's Jewish doesn't mean they cannot be Nazis. In fact, in some of the institutions, the colleges that these guys go to in the West Bank, the rabbis, and it's been recorded and it's been talked about in the Israeli press, have been quoted as saying the Nazis weren't wrong. They were just on the wrong side of the issue. This is something that they say openly. And their entire ideological world is based on the fact that they are a more advanced race and that they have rights that other races, particularly Arabs, do not have. And they compare the Arabs to all these other, you know, ancient nations that the Jews were supposed to destroy. I mean, it's an entire neo-Nazi type of ideology and behavior. Look at them, the way they walk around.
How can a rabbi, and explain what this means, they weren't wrong, they were just on the wrong side of the issue. What issue? And explain that. You got me on this one, man. You got me.
Well, they were not wrong in that Hitler was not wrong in, and of course, this is not me saying.
No, I'm saying.
Sure, we understand this. The Israeli press has been talking about this for a long time. His claim was they were not wrong ideologically. The Nazis, Hitler was not wrong ideologically. There are races that are superior to others.
Okay.
He was wrong because he came out against the Jews.
Okay. He picked the wrong people.
Exactly.
But his idea that, as in Animal Farm, all animals on the farm are equal, just some are more equal than others.
Precisely.
Okay. Wow.
So this is the ideological home from which these people look. I mean, if you look at where they went to college, where they went to school, this is it's a violent racist ideology that is perpetuated in these academies. These are special academies that are built for these people. And today, when you look at a great deal of the officers' corps within the Israeli army, I mean, one of them was just promoted to general. He was so violent that his promotion was delayed for several years. And now, not only was he was promoted, and I talked about this in a previous article, mm-hmm. He was promoted to one of the most prestigious commands in the Israeli military. And he comes, and when you look at where he went to college and where he went to high school, this is what is being taught.
Okay.
It's a form of neo-Nazism.
Miko Peled, The Roots of Evil, right-wing Israeli settler group accuses Palestinians of land theft. You can find it at Mint Press News. As always, Miko, thank you for your work. Thank you for your being so gracious with your time whenever I call. Appreciate your contribution to The Critical Hour.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, according to Common Dreams, the Bolton gambit succeeded. Critics warn top Trump advisor has put UK on path to war with Iran. And Iran claims arrest of 17 spies. Pompeo says Iran has long history of lying. What does this mean going forward? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a Washington author and investigative reporter. He's the editor of the Deep State blog, which can be found at www.deepstateblog.org. He writes about the power and influence of secret intelligence agencies in national and international affairs. Jefferson Morley. Jefferson, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the first story that I mentioned, the Bolton gambit. By threatening Iran with serious consequences without knowing what that may entail, Britain blindly dances to the beat. Your thoughts on this Common Dream story?
Well, the story is in the news because Iran has seized a British tanker, and that's in response to Britain seizing an Iranian tanker, which was very inexplicable because Britain is not in charge of enforcing any sanctions against Iran. There was no legality to the move. And I think that what it shows is that Iran has joined this U.S. campaign of maximum pressure.
You mean Britain?
Iran.
Britain has joined.
With, you know, without any deliberation or debate or description of what it's doing. And so the United States is dragging other countries into this confrontation, and the seizure of the British ship is a very predictable response, that they will take similar measures in response to the pressure that's being put on them. This has been Bolton's plan. He's been talking about regime change, quote unquote, in Iran for decades. So there's no doubt that that's what this administration is aiming to do. What we see going on now is, as Iran responds predictably to these provocations, that then this is presented to the U.S. as Iran somehow being aggressive. You know, we didn't have any of these Iranian moves at a time when Iran and the United States were agreed on the nuclear deal. The two countries were, while not friendly, were not actively engaged in hostile action against each other. The Trump policy has changed that. By tearing up the agreement that Iran was complying with, they have prodded Iran to take actions which they now describe as aggressive, which justify further U.S. aggression against Iran. And we get into this cycle that we don't really know where it's going. This relates to the other story mentioned.
Wait a minute. Before you go to the other story, let me ask you this question. You mentioned Bolton and regime change, and we know that Bolton and Pompeo, but Bolton more than anybody, has been anti-Iran probably since he was 4 years old. When we talk about regime change, they had regime change in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, and that's a worldwide mess. We had regime change in Libya with the removal of Gaddafi. That has exacerbated the worldwide mess in Iraq. If they think they can have regime change in Iran, do they think they know the power force that they're going to be able to install to fill that vacuum? Because if they don't, I could only see now you have taken this equation, this factor, and ratcheted it up to a factor of 10 or 20.
Well, right. Iran is 10 or 15 times as big as Libya. It's twice as big as Iraq, with 70 to 80 million people. I mean, it's folly. But these are people who, when presented with the reality that the invasion of Iraq was a total disaster, it destabilized the region. It made the problem of terrorism in the region 100 times worse than it was. These people are impervious to recognizing the reality. So we can have no confidence that they have learned anything about the previous catastrophes that they have generated. I mean, look at the invasion of Iraq. It was supposed to cause nothing. It was supposed to remove weapons of mass destruction. It was supposed to stop the spread of Al-Qaeda. It failed on every count. It cost $5 trillion.
Those were the lies that they told us. They knew there were no WMDs when they said it. So my question to you would be, is it that the chaos that has ensued is actually the chaos that they want, but they have lied to us with the things that you mentioned to make us think that their plan is otherwise?
I think they don't care about the chaos, the loss of foreign lives, or even the loss of U.S. lives.
I would agree.
If they did, they would not be doing this.
You're right. So what they want is access to resources and markets.
I mean, it's very hard to say what is driving this other than
okay.
kind of irrational hostility. I mean, is it a bid for oil? We didn't get any oil out of invading Iraq. I'm not even sure that that's a plausible policy goal.
Okay.
But whatever it is, whatever the justification is, we can be sure that it is folly. And we are on a path of folly.
I agree with that. I agree with that 1,000%. So now let's move to Iran claims arrest of 17 CIA spies. And I've checked with some folks on my end that are knowledgeable of these things. And they say there aren't even 17 CIA spies in Iran, that there may be two. Your thoughts?
You know, the Iranian claims are impossible to verify. They gave the number 17. They gave no names. They released some pictures, but they did not release any names with the pictures. So I would say the whole thing is unverified and not trustworthy. It may just be for domestic consumption, which is everybody in Iran knows that the U.S. is stepping up warlike pressures on the country, and the government wants to assure the people that they are taking measures in response. I think right now, all we can say is that this is a propagandistic claim. But what we do know is that the CIA is very active in Iran. We know that there's something called the Iran Mission Center within the CIA, which is in charge of CIA operations against Iran. We know that the Iranians broke up a CIA communications system earlier in the decade, in 2010, 2011, that was a major blow to U.S. intelligence operations, both in Iran and China. This was reported by Yahoo News last November. So we have these intelligence wars going on. The two countries are not at war yet, but the two intelligence services are now at war. That's what this headline tells us.
So with the two intelligence services being at war, how far behind is the rest of the country? Are the rest of the countries? Meaning, how far behind the intelligence services are the defense and military operations of the United States and Iran, if that question makes sense?
Yeah, well, if you picture the intelligence agencies as the tip of each country's spear, and those tips are now pointing and jabbing at each other, the larger military establishments behind them cannot be far behind. I mean, it stands to reason that if the intelligence agencies are mobilizing, the military services are going to be doing the same. So now, how far are we away from war? It's very hard to discern any strategy behind what the Trump people are doing because it's so irrational and counter to U.S. interests. And we do know that Trump's ultimate goal is headlines and glory for himself. So he may divert this at the end to some negotiation settlement, negotiation track, like he's done in North Korea,
right,
and upset the hawks on his own team. That's still a possibility. But the problem is, in the meantime, you have these intelligence services and these military forces taking active measures against each other, and that could set off a war that it doesn't make any difference what Trump's ultimate plans are. So we're in a dangerous situation.
We have about 1 minute left, and you may have just answered it, but my out question is, it seems to me as though the Iranians up to this point have been the adults in the room, that they have they have not been the ones to escalate, that they are actually just trying to, if not maintain status quo, de-escalate. How long can you see them holding their ground? Because we know that you've got moderate forces in Iran and you've got aggressive forces in Iran, the same way you have moderate forces and aggressive forces here. So far, the moderate forces over the years, the people have been voting for more moderate policy and greater relationship with the United States. But now, with the actions that the Trump administration is taking, the aggressive forces now seem to be saying, see, we told you you couldn't trust them. So with all of that, I'll let you take us out.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the dynamic that we have to worry about. Now, Iran is very good at responding in a way that does not, that makes their point without driving up the escalation ladder. They seize a tanker, but they don't take violent action. They claim they're arresting U.S. spies. So
they shoot down a drone. They shoot down a drone instead of a passenger jet.
Right. That is what I think we can expect to see more and more of, is Iran responding in a low-key way that is directed at U.S. allies, not at the U.S.
Okay.
And that could go on for a long time.
Okay. Jefferson Morley, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!